So thank you, everybody. Thank you for inviting me, Martin. And I'm glad that you stressed that it's a general broad view, because I have to confess that I don't really know very much at all about the broadcast industry. So what I'd like to do is give you a bit of a very brief history of computing to give you a sense of where cloud computing sits in the overall timeline of how things have developed over the last few decades, and why we've ended up in this, or come to this point in the history of computing. I'll then talk a little bit about the anatomy of a cloud, so talk about the characteristics of what makes a cloud, and what different kinds of clouds there are. We'll then have a little brief look at what are they good for, because they're not a panacea for everything, they're not the new computing platform de rigueur. And then a little bit about how you can get started playing around with clouds today. So, in the beginning was the mainframe. And I guess a few of you will also remember have started using computers on the mainframe the way I did. The mainframe has a very important part in this history of cloud, because mainframes were very expensive, so it was very important to get the most use out of your mainframe. And at the end of the 60s, we developed a technology in IBM that we called virtualization, which enabled you to run multiple machines as virtual machines on top of the same mainframe hardware. So rather than have just the mainframe dedicated to batch processing, this was really about real-time processing, virtual terminals and that sort of thing. We released the IBM 360 as the first fully virtualized hardware platform. And that meant that you could run many, many virtual machines on this same mainframe. And for each of the users, as far as they were concerned, they had a mainframe dedicated to them. And it would run whatever OS that they wanted. And that was all of these machines sharing the CPUs and memory and storage and network that was the underlying platform. And I like that picture because we tend to forget what mainframes really were like, where the memory was over in that box over there and the storage was that box over there. And you really could see what constituted the computer. The whole of that set of things was virtualized and lots of machines running on top. And users would access these machines from thin clients, as we talk about them now. In those days, they were referred to as dumb terminals. But basically, the way you accessed the machine, the virtual machine, was via a screen, but all of the computing power was happening in that virtual machine out in the mainframe. And another key aspect of it was that the mainframe was audited to the minutest degree. Every CPU cycle and piece of storage you used was recorded and audited, so that an organization that had to shell out for a mainframe could then break down the usage of every single piece of it and then charge back that usage to each of the departments and users that were using it. So it was really optimized for utilization. The whole platform, the whole purpose of virtualization was to do this optimization for utilization so you could get the most for your money for the mainframe. So that was the 60s and into the 70s. And then at the end of the 70s and into the 80s, we saw a shift and things were broken apart into the world of the personal computer. And everybody, as you remember, looked very happy to have their own PC on their lap. And it was really the democratization of computing and a shift to enabling more people to have access to computing power that was cheaper, more affordable. And so it was this shift to computers for all, and applications like spreadsheets and word processors were the main drivers for this shift in technology so that people could work on their own with their own machine. And then in the 90s, or by the end of the 80s into the 90s, we then saw a further shift from just the PC being a dedicated machine that only one user had into a network of these machines. And that was known as the client-server architecture, or client-server computing, where users had their own PCs, but these PCs would share something, and often the something would be storage, database, that kind of thing. But typically, the user was using their PC and using what we call a fat client, because the majority of the computing power was still on their personal machine that had been bought for them and sat on their desktop. And they would be sharing a little bit via some server machine elsewhere. And the other point to note was that because these machines were sort of on an individual basis, this was a shift then to the cost being per individual, effectively, or per machine at the very least. So software and licensing and hardware costs were shifted to the individual rather than it was the responsibility of the individual to pay for that machine. And really, this was optimized for agility. The purpose of this was that the PC, the personal computer, was a reusable, general-purpose, commodity kind of machine that could be used for whatever purpose you individually wanted. And then in the beginning of the 90s and through to, well, sort of the, from 93 through to the millennium, we saw the huge explosion of the World Wide Web. The internet had been there for 30 years before that, but it was only when the World Wide Web was invented and became adopted that it really became into the mainstream. And this was a further shift from sharing of computing really to a sharing of content and a further democratization of the network effectively. Interestingly, we see a shift back to thin clients in a way. Although people are accessing the web via their machine, it's the web browser that's effectively the client, and that's effectively back to the dumb terminal model, if you like, almost, in as much as they're accessing some application that really is hosted and being served on a server out on the World Wide Web, and they were using it via their browser. And applications like eBay and first Yahoo and then Google, all these other ones, really drove a huge set of experiences to develop that client-server model into a much more scalable model. And so this was optimized for scale. These things really drove technologies to be able to serve thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of users concurrently to access these applications over the internet. And along the way throughout the 2000s, that was where standards really started to become prevalent and very important, certainly in the IT industry, but across into businesses that wanted to run their business on the internet. And so this was where we started to develop all sorts of things like web services and SOA and service-oriented architectures and grid computing and utility computing to try and, if you like, bring that Tower of Babel back, where everything had got distributed into a heterogeneous mess, into something that would fit together and be able to share a little bit better. And grids especially were trying to aim for what were termed virtual organizations, where in fact the grid notion was that you could have back to that sort of distribution of storage over there and computing over there, being able to draw these separate computing resources over the internet together into one virtual organization. So meanwhile, whilst this evolution of the use of computing was going on, we had a separate evolution, and that was that what we termed the hardware free lunch ran out. Who in the audience is familiar with Moore's law? A few. Oh, good. So I don't have to give a complete breakdown, but for the benefit of those who didn't put their hand up, Gordon Moore was the chief engineer at Intel, and he had tremendous foresight when he predicted back in the 60s that the number of integrated circuits, transistors, that we would be able to fit into a square inch would roughly double every 18 to 24 months, and it would continue to double for the foreseeable future. And turns out, even today, he's still on track. It's pretty much that trend. Now, this led many people, virtually all in the industry, into the false sense of security that there wasn't a problem in terms of performance. Every 18 to 24 months, things would double and things would continue to be more powerful. But although the transistors did continue to shrink and do continue to shrink, the laws of physics prevent us from continuing that trend in terms of power. We're not able to build circuits in the same architecture models that we had had and sufficiently be able to power them and cool them. Basically, you have the sort of density of a nuclear reactor and just melt the silicon. So we had to go back to the drawing board somewhat and figure out how we can re-architect microprocessors but still be able to take advantage of this continuing density of transistors. And so the solution was to scale out rather than to scale up, as we had been doing. This was the introduction of use of multi-core technology the use of commodity hardware. So two trends. And this little sort of set of things here, that picture on the far left is a multi-chip module from a mainframe from the 70s, the way we used to build chips, and that was bipolar technology, was to have multiple CPUs plugged into this ceramic core, and then you'd cool them with water and stuff. But it would be separate chips all just packed together. And then the next one on the right there, the beginning of multi-core, where using the space on that die, we'd be able to effectively put multiple CPUs on the same silicon and have them sharing memory via L2 cache. And then the next one on is the cell processor that we developed for the Sony PlayStation, similar to the ones that we did for the Xbox 360 as well, in as much as it's multiple processors, and this one has 8 mini processors on board along with 2 main CPUs as well. So it starts to become the evolution of system on a chip, basically, so that that MCM that was the original thing now starts to become replicated in silicon in one piece of silicon. So you start to be able to scale out. So the important thing to note is that these processors are not running faster, but you've just got multiple processors. So the only way to take advantage is to run things in parallel. And this picture on the far right was the Road Runner system that we did for Los Alamos National Lab, using cell processors to build a supercomputer that was the best one at the time. I think it was the first one to beat the petaflop bar. But it was made from racks and racks and racks of blade servers running cell processors. So you've got massive scale out, both within the processor and multiple processors across the machines as well. So these trends all looks very rosy, but what's wrong with this picture? Well, the trouble is, going back to this shift from the mainframe to the distributed computing and client-server computing, along the way we lost a lot of the key values that the mainframe had, which was one of them being management capabilities. You manage the mainframe in one way, in a coherent, consistent way across all of the applications. You also had far better utilization of the machines that, overall, and also the redistribution of the costs of the machine overall being able to be charged per use, prorated back to the users of the machines. So the trend of client-server has ended up with data centers being filled with dozens, if not hundreds, of machines that were bought for one purpose, for one application alone. Most of them only sit running at 8% utilization, but they all run, well, not all of them, but most of them tend to be running on different operating systems, different middleware, different application administrative requirements and expertise. All need to be powered, all need to be cooled, and so the trend was just getting worse and worse. So with the current economic climate and with the ecological issues of green issues, all of this just had to really be changed and stopped. And so businesses are now faced with and need to do more with less, being the principal one. So reducing their capital expense on continuing to buy, wasn't that funny? Continuing to buy server machines just to run a specific application. So reduce their capital expense, reduce their operational expense, because every time you put a new machine in, you've got to have somebody administer that machine. Reducing risk as well is another business imperative most of these days. At the same time, though, both in doing more with less and reducing risk, expecting to deliver higher quality services. And finally, being able to do it with breakthrough agility, being able to respond to changes in market opportunities just like that, change the use of your computing to do that, that opportunity at very short notice. So cloud computing effectively has come as a demand for these business imperatives, these climate changes, and also as an evolution of the client-server shift and from mainframe. So there are lots of different definitions for cloud computing, and I chose a nice independent one from Wikipedia, which is as good as any, which is: cloud computing is a style of computing in which dynamically scalable and often virtualized resources are provided as a service over the internet. Users need not have knowledge of or expertise in or control over the technology infrastructure in the cloud that supports them. Now, that's a pretty good succinct definition, and three key words I've highlighted are scalable, virtualized, and as a service. So the cloud is effectively the infrastructure that a particular service runs on. And its infrastructure consists of a collection of resources, computing resources, storage resources, that have been pooled together and then virtualized. And that virtualization then enables you to get much better high utilization. Then there's some set of standardized services running on that pool of virtualized resources. And I won't say much more yet about what those services are, but we'll have a look at those in a minute. But it's a key point that they are standardized. And then the third thing is, as demand increases, more of these virtual resources can be allocated to provide that service, that standard service, through automation, so that there's a requirement of some human in the loop to shovel more coal on. It should automatically happen. And that's what we call elastic scaling of a service. So effectively, it's a combination of the value propositions of the mainframe, the client server, and the web era, all rolled into one, a sort of convergence of these three value propositions. Sounds great, doesn't it? So the way cloud addresses those imperatives of doing more with less, high quality services, breakthrough agility, and reducing risk, well, the virtualization addresses to a certain extent a lot of that doing more with less, because it addresses high utilization, economies of scale benefits, and reducing that capital expense. The standardization is a means by which the resources are more easily accessed, and so it's on that democratization theme. Flexible pricing, we'll look at it a little bit more, but it's about being able to charge and get that pay-per-use kind of quality that we have with the mainframe. Reuse and sharing, standardization is the principal means by which we can, you know, have many people reuse the same commodity resource, whatever that resource is, that service is, but in a variety of different ways. Integration as well, through a standard set of services, it's more easy to use that service in conjunction with other things you've already got. And the automation really is the thing that addresses the breakthrough agility, in as much as that you'll be able to do things more quickly, get effect change more quickly. And we'll look at those over the following slides. So now to the anatomy of the cloud. That's sort of like the brief history of time piece. So there are a variety of what people call clouds. And they have sort of a horizontal dimension, which is a range of deployment options, which we'll look at, and a vertical dimension, which is a range of layers, which we'll also look at. And depending upon where you are in that X and Y axis, you have resources within that you are managing, and these resources change depending upon where you're looking at in the cloud. So starting with that horizontal dimension, which is deployment models. So really there are two principal deployment models, and we'll start with public on the right-hand side, because it's the one that most people are familiar with. So a public cloud is something that is a service that's provided and owned and managed by someone on via the internet, and they provide access to the service typically by some subscription model, so that the users, the subscribers to this service, can access some set of resources, and it's typically on some kind of pay-per-use kind of model. So it really is driven towards customization, efficiency, availability, resilience, security, and privacy. But buzzwords, really. But what it's about is that it, rather than the user having to pay for the machinery to run this service on their own premises, in their own organization, they're accessing it over the internet. They use their credit card or whatever to access that service, and the duration of which they use that service is what they pay for. They don't pay for any more, they don't pay for any less. At the other side, you've got the private cloud, and effectively, that's the same value proposition in terms of the utilization of the hardware, the flexibility of being able to pull this virtualized resources together to be able to use it for a variety of ways, but in a highly densely utilized way. But you own the hardware. The hardware is a pool of machines that you've got in your own data center. So you gain some of the value propositions, like the lower capital expense, the lower operational expense, and through standardization, you get better reuse across your organization. Same deal, but basically you own the hardware. And then we have what we call hybrid scenarios, which is where organizations use both deployment models, and we'll look a little at why you make that choice between one or the other. But just to fill in sort of the details on the spectrum, you can have a variety of different options along the way. So, for instance, a private cloud in an enterprise data center, that enterprise owns all the machines, they've installed a set of software to virtualize those machines, they've installed a set of software to provide some management capability. They own the thing in entirety. Typically, an enterprise that's doing this would do it at the sort of cross line of business level, so the CIO's office or whatever would put that private cloud in and then enable all of the lines of business to be able to utilize that. Otherwise, there's not going to be much benefit in the terms of sharing or utilization. The more people using your cloud, the better the utilization will be. So it's something that is really aimed for by CIOs to get use across their organization. Then the next step up is an enterprise data cloud where it's a managed private cloud. So it's effectively exactly the same deal, but instead of that hardware sitting in their data center, it's sitting in some other company's data center, IBM, for instance, as an outsourcing deal. So for all intents and purposes, it's privately owned, but it's just sitting physically in a different data center. Then the middle one, hosted private cloud, third-party... That third-party managed, the second one, is where somebody comes in and manages it for you on-premise. The middle one is where it's physically off-premise, and they're managing it for you, but you access it as your organization via some VPN or something like that. But the first three, all of them, that private cloud, those machines, are physically dedicated to your enterprise. The next one on, the sort of brown one, shared cloud services. Here it's shared services, so the charging and support services that manifest the cloud are shared across different enterprises, but dedicated resources will be set aside for the enterprise for their particular cloud. So you've got more isolation between these clouds, but they're still running across the same set of machines in some data center off-premise. And then finally, the far right, the users one, the public cloud services for users, This is the sort of thing that we're most familiar with Amazon's EC2 service, Elastic Cloud Compute Cloud service, where it's aimed at individual users going to the website, signing up with their credit card or PayPal or whatever, and requesting some resources for their personal use. And so they're sharing amongst with all the other users. There's no boundaries of isolation from an enterprise or organizational perspective. So you've got a range of options in terms of how you might use or run or deploy a cloud or deploy an application to a cloud. So that's a horizontal layer perspective. From a vertical layer perspective, let's look at that lower one first, the infrastructure one. So this is commonly termed as infrastructure as a service, IaaS. And examples are Amazon with their EC2 cloud and their storage cloud. IBM, we have a smart business dev and test cloud. Those are public ones. From a private perspective, VMware with their set of software enables you to build your own private infrastructure as service on your own machines. Then you've got other public services like GoGrid, Rackspace. There's a lot out there. Basically, an infrastructure as a service is wrapping up the use of computing infrastructure and delivering it as a service. So, in other words, rather than you have dedicated machines, it's you going to the service requesting a virtual machine. So, it's just like that mainframe virtual machine notion we started with, where you go to a website, you choose, I want three machines, I want them to be quad-core, I want them to have 2 gig of RAM and 500 gig of storage, and I want them for 3 hours. And you pay whatever that costs on a per CPU basis, and they're provisioned and assigned for your use, they're given IP addresses, you access them over the internet, do whatever you want with them, and after 3 hours or whatever you set for, they go away. So it's about the computing infrastructure being virtualized and then delivered to you over the internet. I'll switch to the top end of the cloud next and talk about the applications. And this is commonly known as software as a service, or SaaS. With every computing trend, there's always a whole load of acronyms that sound stupid. And in cloud, everything is as at the end of it. So SaaS is all about delivering software as a service rather than the infrastructure. So the most canonical one, the one that most people know and understand in the industry, is Salesforce.com. Salesforce, I think they started in about 2001, actually. They deliver a CRM application, much like Siebel and PeopleSoft and that kind of stuff. Not PeopleSoft, Siebel, sorry. And they deliver it as the application, but over the internet. And their sort of moniker is no software, you know, sort of a cross out thing. And the idea is, rather than pay the price to install a CRM application, buy the machines, install your CRM application, employ somebody to manage it, or outsource somebody to manage it, all of those costs go away. You just go with your credit card and say, I want an account, and you've got a CRM application, you know, within minutes. Very attractive value proposition. And there are a number of other applications that lend themselves very well to this. So Taleo is an HR application as a service. Google, I mean, you can think of Google Search as itself as software as a service in a sense, but Google have also developed a lot of applications like Google Docs, Google Mail, etc., as applications that in the old days you would have had on your PC installed as an application. Now you just go via the web browser and use that application, no software on your machine. IBM's done the same with Lotus, the Lotus suite of applications, productivity suite. We deliver as a service on Lotus Live. And NetSuite, they're a set of CRM and ERP kind of applications. So there's an awful lot of these as a service applications starting to appear now. And actually, I saw one the other day which was I thought quite interesting, which is a company called or a site called Pixlr, I think, pixlr.com, which is effectively a Photoshop application as a service. So instead of installing Photoshop, you just go via the browser to their website and you can start editing your photos and your artwork in a full functional photo editing application. It's delivered over the internet via a Flash as the client, so sort of getting 60 frames a second of real-time experience. So lots and lots of different sorts of applications, and with increasing bandwidth, the ability to increase that range of applications that can be delivered as a service. Then in the middle, we have what we call platform as a service. And this is a much more emerging space and something that is less well-defined, certainly. Google has a good example with their App Engine. Salesforce extended their offering to have a platform called Force.com. Microsoft have a service called Azure. We're working on things as well. But the main gist of the platform as a service is it's your applications, but you're not requesting the machines individually. You're deploying your applications to this platform delivered in the cloud as some kind of service. The catch here, though, is it's going to be some specific platform. So, for instance, with Google App Engine, you have to write to their programming model. With Force.com, you have to write to their programming model. The two programming models are different. And so you have to make your choice as to what particular platform you want to go for, write your application in that particular way, and then you provision it in the cloud. And of course, not all of those platforms may be available in both a public and a private instance, and if you want to have those hybrid scenarios, you need to be mindful of whether or not you want to be able to have that sort of portability. Just before we leave this sort of layering system, this is IBM's architectural view of cloud computing. Many companies have similar kind of sort of architecture diagrams. We take ours quite literally, for good reason. And it's that a cloud platform is at the underpinning built on some form of virtualized hardware, some virtualized infrastructure. Then there's some layer of middleware that enables the sharing of that virtualized set of resources in some particular kind of platform model. Then there are services, platform services delivered on top of that shared middleware that are aligned to specific application or business needs, such as process management, business process management, collaboration applications, analytics, business analytics, etc. And then on top of those services, applications actually, the SaaS, as a service kind of applications, are then built and delivered. As a counter to that, for instance, Salesforce.com, when they built Salesforce in the first instance, they hadn't built it as a cloud. It was something as a service, software as a service, but didn't get talked about as cloud. The reason they switched to building it as a cloud architectural model was because the only way they could accommodate scale and get that utilization and cost efficiency to run their service was to build it using cloud paradigms. And once they built that cloud, they then realized, oh, actually, we could offer this as a platform as a service as well. So sort of offer what they'd built to support their own application as a service. And you see similar things with Google, with Amazon as well. So let's now quickly switch to what sort of cloud workloads you can run, and what are they good for and what are they not good for. And in 2009, last year, we ran a pretty extensive set of market research. We interviewed a lot of our customers, the IT and line of business decision makers. What were they thinking of cloud? What were they using clouds for? What were they intending to do with clouds? And we asked a range of choices about where were they choosing to purchase their clouds from, or what were their cloud delivery and deployment models, why were they doing it, what kind of applications were they running or aiming to run or hoping to run, how fast were they going to adopt cloud computing, and what kind of preparations were they making for it. And the net result really was that we got some, amongst that, top workloads that people were using clouds for. And the interesting thing, but maybe not surprising thing, is that the workloads do differ between public and private deployments. So the top public cloud workloads, audio, video, web conferencing, those kinds of collaboration applications, service help desk kind of applications, infrastructure for training and demonstration purposes, wide area network capacity and voice over IP infrastructure for delivering internal VoIP, virtualized desktop services, development and test environments for developing their own applications and infrastructure, storage, and network capacity, and just general purpose server usage. So mostly focused around infrastructure and collaboration, but typically stuff that's not core high business value, but stuff that's more supporting auxiliary infrastructure kind of requirements. Typically ones that are not security sensitive, data privacy sensitive. So it's a sort of a confidence thing, really. And so that's why people have, what people are typically using public for. For private, they cited data mining, text mining, other kind of business analytics, security infrastructure, data warehousing and data marts, which is kind of along with the analytics stuff, business continuity, disaster recovery, high availability stuff, test environment infrastructure, interestingly as well, data archiving, preservation, transactional databases, so master data repositories, things like that, they would keep on-premise, but still gain the benefits of that virtualization and high utilization. ERP applications, that's an interesting one, that they're actually still running their ERP applications as they were, but on virtualized infrastructure rather than necessarily switching to Salesforce, for instance. So database, application, infrastructure, slightly more core business value kind of stuff is kept on-premise. So over all of the responses, it starts to sort of pan out as a kind of a map of what's there, what's not, what kind of is, and what kind of won't be. And if you can see, the ones with the little sort of shields denote what's typically highlighted as private workloads, and the little world ones are public workloads. Those in orange are sort of emerging, so still considered or were considered a little early for use of cloud. And then as they get darker green, the middle green is what they're doing already, and then the darker green is what they were looking forward to anticipating using public clouds for, or private clouds. So you see sort of in the green section, this is sort of the homeland of what people have been doing today, is those range of workloads that we just went through. And you see a fair mixture. But just thinking the key points, really, the sensitive data and the regulation sensitive. Regulation sensitive, for instance, an example being being able to assure that personal information is maintained in the geographic location of the country that originated. So this has been a sensitive point that has encouraged people to keep on-premise rather than going into the cloud. Lots of the cloud providers are rapidly trying to address that by having data centers located in all of the countries that care about this so that they can do some level of assurance. An interesting one, though, is that depending upon where you are in that layer of the stack, it may be easier or harder to be able to make that assurance as to where the data is actually stored. A lot of the SaaS level applications, because of their virtualization being quite broadly spread, it's pretty much impossible for them to pinpoint where the data or particular data is at a particular time. Whereas more at the IaaS level, where you're sort of your granularity of the resource that you're pulling out is much more cleanly delineated, and so it's easier for the cloud providers to be able to say that is definitely running in Germany or whatever. So that's something to consider. So a very quick three examples of the kind of public workloads that were highest that IBM have provided services for. One is the smart development and test on the IBM cloud. So this is the workloads where many of our customers, they want to use virtual machines in the cloud publicly to rapidly provision machines for R&D purposes. So they're not delivering the services to their customers on these machines, but they're using them to develop those services and develop those applications. And the principal cost with development test is the cost of setting those machines up, getting those machines in place, running the tests, and then what do you do with them if then you've lost utilization. So development test is a very costly exercise using infrastructure, which use of public short-lived cloud resources can be very apt for. Our service is pretty much light for light with EC2, even on the price point. It's you go, you choose a particular image for, you know, whether it's a Linux image or a Windows image or whatever, whether it's running particular pieces of middleware or software. I want one of those for 2 hours, and it's provisioned. You use it for those 2 hours over the network, and then it goes away. In actual fact, I think it's now 50% of all development teams in IBM now are using this kind of model for their development and test organizations. We no longer dedicate machines to dev and test. We just use these shared resources in our public cloud. Then you've got our smart business storage cloud. So the same sort of deal, but instead of computing resources that you're requesting, this is storage. And again, a very similar sort of offering to Amazon Storage Cloud. But it's basically, again, a multi-tenant solution where you want some robust, highly available, large amount of storage, but you don't want to pay for the management and physical hardware for use of that. Again, you're paying for what you're using rather than paying for particular disks, particular spindles, and then using up to that. This is an interesting one, and probably one of the ones that's particularly relevant for this industry, I imagine, because it's a way of having highly flexible storage uses, highly distributed storage uses, but without having to put in the infrastructure yourself to accommodate that. And then the third one is desktop virtualization. We have a smart business desktop cloud, which is instead of the end user in the organization having a desktop machine set up for them with all of their particular applications on, whether they're productivity or development test or technical applications, the desktop image that they would typically run shrunk down onto some virtual machine that is then running in the cloud, and they access it via remote desktop technology. So this really is right back to that mainframe model at the beginning, where you're accessing the full machine, but via a very thin, dumb terminal client, which is the remote desktop technology. And this is, again, hugely attractive to organizations where they're rolling out large numbers of desktops, because it shrinks the management down to just one place. All of the administration and maintenance and management of running that desktop is focused into one cost and one administration point. A lot of schools these days are doing this as well. My son's school, they've got, rather than delivering all of these PCs, they have remote desktops into a cloud solution. So that was a quick sort of overview of the different sorts of workloads that are quite typical at the moment. I now want to look quickly. Have I got enough time? Because I'm going to have to go very quickly. Looking a little bit beyond that infrastructure as a service level. So with the infrastructure as a service approach, again, you're looking for the cloud to provide CPUs, memory, storage, networking, etc. And once you've got those machines, the world's your oyster. You can do with what you like. That's a benefit or a drawback, depending upon which way you look at it, because it's only taken some of the cost out of the whole experience. Now, with shared middleware, or a platform as a service approach, your central abstraction isn't the virtual machine, but it's the application itself. And so rather than the cost of setting up the environment, the topology of machines to support your application, the pattern of machines that you need to replicate to create the environment necessary for your application, your platform should provide that for you underneath the covers, and you're just describing the requirements your application has. So the platform as a service has a viewpoint on the application rather than just the infrastructure resources. And to illustrate this point, let's just sort of compare. So in a non-cloud environment, what does it take typically to run an application in an organization? Well, first of all, you'd have to acquire and set up the hardware. There may be a purchasing process in your organization that means that you've instantly spent 6 months before you even get the hardware in the data center. There's obviously hardware cost as well, because you've got to pay for the machine before you've used it. You then have to, once you've got that, set up the OS. You're going to have to install the fixes, the patches, the latest levels, yada-da-da-da. Now you're ready to install the necessary middleware. And if it's a complex application, it's going to be using a database over there or a messaging middleware over there. And these are typically going to be different sets of expertise required to administer those pieces of middleware. You've also got all of the associated patches and dependencies and whatnot. So now you've got the configuration of that set of machines with a set of middleware to actually talk to each other. What should be trivial often turns out to be about another 6 months worth of tinkering around to get it all working. And you now are ready to install your application on it. So now you're at the point where you've got the application running. You've all got all of the tuning and maintenance of the environments underneath as an ongoing lifecycle concern. So an awful lot of time and money can be burnt just to get the application up and running. Now, if we switch, compare that with the infrastructure as a service usage, you've shrunk the first three tasks down into a very small no-op, effectively, which is I've chosen the hardware I want, the operating system I want, and the middleware I want. I want three of those machines with these different types of software on. Give me that. That can happen instantaneously, and you can pay for what you've just used instantaneously. Then it's sort of business as usual from then on. You've still got to configure those machines into the pattern you need and then get your application running, etc. But with a platform approach, you further shrink those a couple more of those tasks where you can say, I want this particular set of, this topology or pattern of infrastructure to run my application. Give me that pattern. Once I've got the pattern running, I can then just drop my application onto it, and then I've only worried about maintaining my application. So the trouble is, nothing, of course, is for free. On the vertical axis, the y-axis, we've got operational expense, the overall cost, and on the lower, the flexibility of what you're getting for your money. So at the far end, at the sort of the far left, that's a sort of a white space. You buy your own machines and do what you want with them. So the cost for that is very high, but the world's your oyster. You can do whatever you want. You can install whatever variation of whatever OS and whatever middleware you want to run your application. Go knock yourself out. It's going to cost you that flexibility, though. At the far end, you've got no flexibility. You're paying for a very specific thing, but the cost is rapidly ramped down because you're sharing that cost across all the other users. So just to illustrate that, native install, moving on to an IaaS set of scenarios, then these middleware platform as a service topology patterns in the middle, and then finally SaaS, software as a service, further out. With use of Salesforce, for instance, you don't get to choose how they run their database. You shouldn't care, so long as they honour the requirements and the SLAs that you're paying for the availability and integrity of that data. The unexpected effect from that, potentially, though, is that as the flexibility goes down and the cost goes down, the ease of deployment goes up and the number of deployments goes up, because the less flexibility you have, the easier it is to get going. So it's like taking those chunks out when you've taken those chunks out, you've standardized on sets of choices, which particular OS, which particular set of middleware, etc. But you've, because you've taken those choices out, you can do it very quickly. And if you can do it very quickly, you can do lots very quickly. And so that's where the agility goes up. Now, I am very, very close to the end. So really the way we recommend people start thinking about whether they want to use a cloud and how they should go about it is, first of all, understand your organization's strategic direction. You know, where is your core value, and what do you want to do with a cloud service? What's the business problem that you're trying to address? And once you've got that, then assess the workloads that you want to be able to use cloud for. Is the workload that you want to run suitable, appropriate for running in a cloud? Is it suitable for running in a public cloud, or is it suitable for a private cloud, or will it need a mixture of the two in a hybrid scenario? And then once you've established that, define the business value that you're going to get from moving from a regular to a cloud version. Then decide whether or not is it an IaaS, is it a PaaS, is it a SaaS kind of layering that you want to aim for. Where on that flexibility curve do you want to get the benefit? And then finally, go do it. And so IBM has three range of offerings. We've got public cloud services, the ones that I went through very briefly before. We have a private cloud platform set, and this is called the WebSphere Cloud Burst Appliance. It's one of several things we've got, where effectively it's a box that you stick in a rack, and it acts as the sort of front end to as an IaaS. So you can say, I want a topology of machines of these particular images, go do. You provide the virtualization hardware, and it does the rest. And then we have whole systems, private cloud systems, where we provide racks of blade centers with all of the necessary cloud management stuff on already. And then very finally, this year we released the latest version of our mainframe, what is now called Z Enterprise. And this really is a real return back to converging everything that we've spoken about today into one place. So it's those multi-chip modules now are multi-chip modules again, but those chips, of course, have many, many cores on them. So overall, the multi-chips altogether adds up to 96 cores being treated as one set of virtual cores, 3 terabytes of RAM, mixed workloads. So it's not just batch, it's not just real-time, it's not just scalar, it's not just floating point, whatever you want to mix across it. Basically, it's all of those sort of amalgamations of virtualization and utilization driven together to get effectively one whole cloud in one management system. And I think that's all I've got. Thank you.